You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the October 2023 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Chef's Menu. Daniel Boulud shares his go-to spots in New York City as his namesake restaurant turns 30, by Kayla Holiday. The vibe of the city was so high, there was hope of change, and New York was New York. There was opportunity, says Daniel Boulud, of arriving in 1982. A 27-year-old chef eager to tantalize the American palate with French cuisine. The time of Delmonico's and the Four Seasons, he says, that was a real inspiration, understanding that it'd be great to be a part of this history. Attuned to the possibilities, I decided to live on the Upper East Side and make that my village. Now, with seven establishments dotting Manhattan, his first, Restaurant Daniel, celebrated 30 years this spring. Boulud takes Vanity Fair for a spin through the city, where he hopes he might always continue to create. In the photos, Boulud hails a taxi or takes his BMW. To be seen, stop by his Blue Box Cafe at the Tiffany & Company flagship, launched this spring. For French children's books, Albertine is a favorite. We can never get enough. To enjoy live music, he's off to Bimmelman's Bar in the Carlisle Hotel. Georgie Box is often lunch on my desk. I receive, send, and also have the flowers at Daniel done by Bunch. It's the way they are arranged and how they speak to nature, almost romantic. To a chef, the most important tool is his knife. Corinne is always the store. And Negroni at Overstory, the Polo Bar, or Daniel's Lalique Bar. For a view of the city, Summit One Vanderbilt. Illustrations by Lauren Tamaki. Now we move on to my stuff, Viva l'Italia. From her caftans to her wallpaper, designer J.J. Martin lives a life in Milan of glorious maximalism. Style file, everyday bag, my Lutz Morris Parker. Beloved jewelry, a giant Egyptian pendant gifted to me by former Chanel Global CEO Maureen Chiquet. To lounge, LGR for blasé sunglasses, La Double J caftan, and VB Venezia Venetian slippers. On wellness, body care, Verdin Urbanum Wash. Skin boost, Phyto Nectar's I Am Radiant. Daily rituals, breath work, chakra cleansing, yin yoga, and multidimensional energy meditations. For healing, weekly shamanic spiritual lesson with Leilama Shemar. For pleasure, listening to the Footloose soundtrack. Reading We the Arcturians, A True Experience by Norma J. Milanovic et al. Watching Il Gattopardo. Inspired by the unnamed Franco-Flemish artist who designed this circa 15th century Millefleur tapestry. At home, on the wall, my portrait painted by Les Dubourgés' former design director, Molly Malloy, two very Zen circle paintings done by my energy healer, Paolo Niccolo Faraguti, and in my dining room, custom wallpaper based on collages I found in Bali, painted by Kirsten Singh-Kongli. On the shelf, my new book, Mama Milano. On the floor, a Tibetan tiger rug and Chinese carpet, both from the 1930s. Vintage gem, a pair of 1950s curved walnut Carlo Ratti chairs. Most maximal, my four closets. The menu, morning cup, Dr. Linda Lancaster's liver cleansing drink, freshly made. Home-cooked specialty, Faro linguine with a tomato, olive, and caper sauce that I learned how to make by watching the chef at a tiny restaurant in Pantelleria Indulgent drink, Aperol Spritz. Around Milan, must see Casa degli Italiani. For print lovers, Bonvini 1909. Vintage, Cavalli e Nastri. Date night, Ratana. Dessert, sachet torte from Pasticceria Cucci. Best kept secret, the painted ceiling inside Chiesa di San Maurizio al Monastero Maggiore. Beauty break, massage at UOF. Day trip, Passalacqua in Lake Como. Lakeside, Colville Beach bag. To keep the city close, Inside Milan by Niccolò Castellini Baldissera. Souvenir, shrink-wrapped Parmigiano Reggiano from Peck. On the road, travel day footwear, a high-top Nike Air Jordans. Carry-on, pine-green Paravel aviator roller. Never without, Australian bush flower essences for jet flag, a Vodafone global cell phone plan, and Ram Dass YouTube lectures. long day's journey. Sure, geniuses should be allowed to make endless films, but what's everybody else's excuse? By Natalie Jarvie. With opening illustration by Jorge Arevalo, which shows patrons in a darkened movie theater, some of them enraptured, some looking decidedly bored, some asleep. When Brad Pitt first read Damien Chazelle's script for Babylon, it was 180 pages, which translates to about 3 hours of screen time. I said, this thing is a masterwork, but what's going to get cut? The actor later told W, because it's really hard just to get 120 pages in there. And he said, nothing. For better, or what many reviewers said was worse, Chazelle was right. Everything the writer-director dreamed up seemed to have made the final cut, including an elephant's explosive bowels. Chazelle had previously made the acclaimed films La La Land and Whiplash, so he was a legitimate talent to bank on. But Babylon reportedly needed to make about $250 million to break even and pulled in just $63 million worldwide. Pitt and Margot Robbie are not generally thought of as liabilities, to say the least. So might the movie's excess have been part of the problem? The length of movies has been creeping up for years, even as streaming, TikTok, and absolutely everything else in our culture has rewired our brains to respond to shorter and shorter bursts of content. Because we've adapted to new rhythms of storytelling, binging a 5-hour limited series is a guilty pleasure, whereas watching a 3-hour movie can be painful. Yet how often have you gone to the movies lately and been, in the words of Nicole Kidman, not just entertained, but somehow reborn in under 2 hours? In 2002, the average length of the top 20 box office performers was 1 hour and 59 minutes. 20 years later, moviegoers were gifted, if that's the word, with an extra 13 minutes of footage on average. Maybe you recently saw a kids' movie or a horror flick that was less than 2 hours long. And yes, Barbie actually was everything, including a delicious 1 hour and 54 minutes. But for a host of reasons, including the fact that studios are trying to lure audiences to theaters with the kind of spectacles they can't get at home, even signing up to see a superhero movie or sequel these days likely means you're in for a marathon. This year has served up the longest installments yet in both the Indiana Jones and John Wick franchises. Even the Little Mermaid remake is nearly an hour longer than the original animated film. And if you want to keep up with legendary directors, or legends in the making, you might need to download the Run P app, Christopher Nolan's atomic bomb epic, and likely Best Picture nominee Oppenheimer, clocks in at 3 hours and required 11 miles of IMAX film. Martin Scorsese's Killers of the Flower Moon, another near-certain Oscar contender, is 3 hours and 26 minutes, about which Scorsese had this to say to Deadline. It's a commitment. I say to the audience out there, if there is an audience for this kind of thing, make a commitment. Your life might be enriched. The length of movies has been debated forever for both creative and commercial reasons. Back in 2000, the talented Mr. Ripley director Anthony Minghella lamented, "There's this strange preoccupation in America with length, and in the most bizarre way. We paid $8, don't give us too much." Elizabeth Frank, who leads programming for AMC Theaters, says the company has people looking into the length of movies to see if it truly constitutes a problem. Jason Blum, a producer known for horror films like Megan and Paranormal Activity, has already come to a conclusion. I think it's a problem. Movies are too long. For executives, of course, lengthy movies mean added production cost, marketing challenges, and fewer available showtimes to recoup their investment. The studios are definitely not encouraging three-hour movies. That I can guarantee, says a senior movie executive. As a consumer, speaking for myself, and on behalf of many other people like me, enough already. Geniuses like Andrei Tarkovsky and Stanley Kubrick made brilliant long movies, says Grant Singer, whose first feature, the crime thriller Reptile, debuts on Netflix this year. But the idea that a contemporary movie would be long, important, and a blockbuster, it all starts with James Cameron, he says. He has proven that you can make hugely successful global sensations that are three-hour films, and people will come to the box office. While audiences might make an exception for something titanic like Avatar or The Batman, they have their limits. One studio executive, citing internal data, tells me that moviegoers become increasingly less interested in a movie the longer it is. Cate Blanchett was a force of nature in Tar, but the film's two-hour, 38-minute runtime may well have contributed to the fact that it made only $6.7 million domestically. Even overseas, where audiences are allegedly more sophisticated, it took in just $22.3 million. The drop-off in interest is said to be especially pronounced for parents. They're more likely to skip a movie they're interested in if it's longer than 2 hours, because the extra time means arranging extra child care, or if they're bringing the kiddos along, enduring even more kid content. We joke that the difference between a 2-hour, 59-minute movie and a 3-hour movie is an hour, the exec says. It literally is the decision for people. So apart from the genius loophole, why have movies become so long? To put it bluntly, as one top agent does, because producers have gotten so short. As the sun set on super producers like Harvey Weinstein, famously nicknamed Harvey Scissorhands, because he cut movies down with such relish, no one rose to take their place. The ability to work hand in glove with a world-class director to shape a movie, very few producers possess that skill or willingness today, the agent says. Directors, to extend the metaphor, are getting taller. There are only so many proven hitmakers. And it's been a seller's market as the number of buyers keeps growing, with Netflix, Amazon, Apple, and others jumping into the original film game. On streaming, you don't have to worry about showtimes or bathroom breaks anyway. That's what the pause button is for. Executives are still incentivized to make the best possible movie, but the conversation is a little different if a filmmaker feels strongly that they need those extra 5 or 30 minutes. Who wants to be the executive who says no to Scorsese and loses him to a competitor? When a director signs on his contract, and let's be real, it's still almost always a man, states how long the film is expected to be and whether he has final cut, also known as approval over all edits. Working with a filmmaker who has final cut doesn't necessarily mean anything goes. If a film is running longer than the promised length, producers will encourage edits, and test screenings can be an important tool with particularly self-indulgent directors. One longtime producer suspects that fewer test screenings during the pandemic might have contributed to the glut of two-hour-plus films in recent years. There's nothing better to tell you that your movie is too long than looking at a sea of people who are shifting in their seats, he says. That's why, after Bardo fell flat at the Venice Film Festival, Alejandro Iñárritu decided to shave 22 minutes from his deeply personal film. Blum, whose movies tend to be low-cost, under 2 hours, and popular with moviegoers, gives all his directors final cut. But that doesn't mean I'm a wallflower, he says. People who finance movies need to have more healthy, creative, real conversations with their filmmakers as opposed to just saying yes. I think the filmmakers want that too. They want partners. They may not listen to the opinion, but they don't just want to do whatever. They want to have a conversation with people they trust, people who understand what they're doing. Swamp Things Ron DeSantis won't hesitate to race Trump to the bottom. Take it from a native Floridian by Carl Hiassen, with the illustration of Trump and DeSantis by Ron Burke. Here in guilt-free Florida, we're often asked if Ron DeSantis is really worse than Donald Trump. Not long ago, the question would have seemed ludicrous because Trump had set the bar of execrable behavior so high. Who could outpander the most prolific panderer of all time? Who could be worse for democracy than the person who snuggled up to murderous dictators, spoke fondly of white supremacists, smeared Mexican immigrants as rapists and killers, tried to overturn an election, and incited a goon siege of the Capitol? The list goes on. Technically, the ex-president isn't a true Florida man. He's just another rich tax refugee. DeSantis is a native, one of our own, and he has proven himself to be just as thin-skinned, soulless, and vengeful as Trump. Betraying his political godfather to seek the Republican presidential nomination demanded more of DeSantis than casual disloyalty. He needed a metaphorical crowbar to pry his perpetually pinched lips from Trump's ass. From then on, his strategy was to slither past Trump on the right. As governor, he has delightedly signed new laws targeting the LGBTQ plus community, abortion rights, gun restrictions, voting liberties, conversations about the history of racism, and from his boundless wall of spite, Disney. All that plus, according to a campaign video, a personal endorsement from God. And still DeSantis is polling a drab, distant second to Trump. Clearly, the governor isn't getting credit for being as awful as he is. Have people already forgotten that his mid-pandemic reversal on COVID vaccines killed off untold numbers of Floridians who'd naively looked to him for guidance? It takes the icy soul of a fentanyl dealer to factor customer mortality into your own marketing plan. Although critics say DeSantis is Trump light, the two differ sharply. DeSantis isn't lazy, and he actually likes to read. On stage, he sticks to a script, while Trump prefers rambling bombast. Some claim Trump has a better sense of humor, but it was DeSantis who appointed a January 6th rioter to the state board that oversees massage parlors. Trump has the big reputation for dodging questions, but DeSantis is hardcore slippery. While his wife, Casey, was undergoing chemotherapy for breast cancer, DeSantis refused to confirm or deny that he'd received the newest COVID booster. Afraid to rile his new anti-vaccine base, the once mask and pro-vax governor clammed up from late December 2021 to mid-January 2022 when the virus raged. New cases in Florida topped 60,000 a day, filling ERs, ICUs, and funeral homes. Everyone familiar with cancer is aware that chemotherapy can weaken immune systems, increasing one's vulnerability to COVID. Yet when asked if he got the booster shot, DeSantis wouldn't say no or yes, even if it was only to protect his wife. Gutless was how Trump described such dodges. But DeSantis showed his true self by resisting the pressure to set a good example and to appear caring. More than 89,000 Floridians have died of COVID, but the governor sustains his campaign vibe by not mentioning them. He has, however, revealed that Casey DeSantis responded very well to her chemo treatments. As a hands-on autocrat, DeSantis methodically built the most regressive, intrusive, and punitive state bureaucracy in the nation. Despite a hurricane of legal challenges, the governor continues to gloat about his no-win feud with Disney, his venomous Don't Say Gay crusade, his useless election police, and his random flyouts of non-Florida migrants to blue states. DeSantis has fearlessly arranged for all these expensive stunts to be paid for with public dollars. Abetted by zombie supermajorities in the State House and Senate, DeSantis has spearheaded so many defective laws that this year nearly $16 million was budgeted for legal expenses, much of it to keep pace with the growing torrent of litigation. Clearly, he's a more agile swamp dweller than Trump. Forget about garish Mar-a-Lago. Did you know the governor's mansion in Tallahassee has a cabana? Amenities include that expensive golf simulator machine provided by Mori Hosseini, a wealthy developer who has also let the governor use his private plane. As reported by the Washington Post, companies controlled by Hosseini donated more than $360,000 to political groups that backed DeSantis' re-election bid in 2022. 3 weeks after his landslide win, the state announced it was setting aside $92 million in unspent COVID relief money for the building of an Interstate 95 interchange at the future site of a sprawling Hosseini retail and housing project near Daytona Beach. Ironically, the funds were plucked from President Joe Biden's American Rescue Plan, which DeSantis had previously denounced. Trump is too scattered to orchestrate such windfall paybacks for major donors. DeSantis is a detail guy. For instance, when devising his scheme to relocate Colombian and Venezuelan migrants using private flights, the governor's team made sure that the $1 million plus in state payments went to a small panhandle aviation company with GOP connections. Another bad thing that DeSantis does better than Trump is nullify legitimate elections. In 2020, Key West voters overwhelmingly passed 3 ballot initiatives aimed at limiting the size and number of cruise ships docking at their small port. The Goliath vessels churn trails of heavy silt that clouds the fishing waters and damages fragile reefs. But after companies owned by the operator of Key West's busiest cruise pier gave $1 million to the governor's political action committee, DeSantis signed legislation barring local governments from restricting commerce in their own ports, wiping out the islanders' vote. Today, the cruise liners are back, towering grotesquely above Key West's historic waterfront. Almost all the governor's despotic fantasies have come true, including a new law that makes secret his past and future travels while on the state payroll. He also asserted more power over the university system, allowing him to install far-right loyalists to take over New College, a small liberal-leaning school in Sarasota. Another swampy move was importing ex-Nebraska GOP Senator Ben Sasse to be president of the University of Florida at an annual base salary of $1 million. Pitbull is better qualified for the job and would probably do it for free. Trump scoffs at his rival's anti-woke obsession, but DeSantis has succeeded at stifling discussions of gender identity and black history in public education. Books are now being yanked from Florida school libraries and classrooms for review if just one person complains. That person often belongs to the Moms for Liberty, the governor's favored purge squad. Novels by a span of authors from Judy Blume to Aldous Huxley to Toni Morrison, and full disclosure, myself, have been pulled from school shelves. A Miami Lakes pre-K through 8th grade school actually flagged the hill we climb Amanda Gorman's best-selling inauguration poem as inappropriate for younger children after a parent claimed to have deciphered hate messages in the verses. The Gorman backlash drew a Trump-worthy response from DeSantis. "This is some book of poems. I never heard of it. I had nothing to do with any of this." In Indian River County, the school board recently repealed a racial equity policy that had been in place 3 years with strong support from teachers and black leaders. The board chair admitted that she acted out of fear of retribution by the governor and drafted a broader version of the policy. Meanwhile, the NAACP issued an extraordinary travel advisory for Florida, warning that under DeSantis, the state is waging an all-out attack on people of color, LGBTQ plus residents, ballot rights, immigrants, women's reproductive rights, and free speech. The governor lost not a wink of sleep. Like Trump, he knows he can't win a tight national election if the racists and homophobes stay home. DeSantis's most unpopular moves are meant to impress ultra-conservatives in the upcoming primaries. His 6-week abortion limit would have been crushed in Florida if it had appeared as a ballot referendum. The same goes for his weakening of gun laws in a state where two of the country's worst mass shootings have occurred, the massacres at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando and Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland. Fans needn't worry about DeSantis suddenly sprouting a conscience or veering toward the political center. As of midsummer, he still hadn't admitted that he rolled up his sleeve for a COVID booster when his wife was in chemotherapy. Only a moron or a monster would risk the life of a sick loved one by spurning the most up-to-date vaccine. And DeSantis isn't a moron. Look at what he's done to Florida. Then imagine what he would do as president. Rock bottom is the limit, if only America would give him a chance. War of the Worlds. The U.S. military is pivoting its training operations from the anti-guerrilla tactics used in Afghanistan and Iraq to plans for a full-on, dug-in, nuclear-armed confrontation with an enemy superpower like Russia or China. Novelist and ex-Marine Phil Clay and photojournalist Peter Van Ockmill report on war's grave new frontier. Into the breach. Opening photo. Soldiers before a mock assault at Fort Johnson, formerly Fort Polk, Louisiana. And next photo, GIs play cards between training exercises. America's military is preparing for a different kind of war. After 2 decades in Iraq and Afghanistan, fighting insurgents and terrorist groups who used guerrilla-style tactics, the U.S. armed forces have a new focus, peer-to-peer combat. War between great nations with large militaries. War, hypothetically, with Russia or with China. Combat of the sort America hasn't engaged in since Korea. As alarming as it may sound, every branch of the Defense Department is currently undergoing a major restructuring, reevaluating doctrine, weaponry, tactics, and training to prepare for just this kind of war. After a recent trip to Washington, D.C., to help military experts workshop peer-to-peer war, Austrian Army officer Franz Stefan Gatti, an adjunct senior fellow at the Center for a New American Security, told me that this new cultural and tactical pivot among the world's major powers could be as big of a change as going from frontier soldiers chasing Comanches to the Civil War. As a result, Peter Van Ockmill's photos on these pages showing recent exercises by the 101st Airborne's 2nd Brigade Combat Team don't just document training for air assaults and ambushes, a tactic once memorably defined by Lieutenant Colonel Charles Armstrong as an act of premeditated murder and terrorism against strangers. At Fort Campbell, Kentucky, and later at Fort Johnson, Louisiana, formerly Fort Polk, which Van Ockmill also documented, soldiers of the brigade learned to fight at night against electronic warfare jamming, against unmanned aerial systems and counterfire radars. They learned to breach complex mine and wire obstacles, to defeat enemy motorized counterattacks. Even before the Russian invasion of Ukraine, we oriented on high-end combat against a peer threat, explained Colonel Ed Matthias, the brigade's commander. Peers, of course, are America's fellow superpowers. In practice, that means thousands of soldiers operating in synchronicity to deliver overwhelming firepower. And in an era of drones and other high-tech surveillance assets to help adversaries deliver fire at long range, soldiers can't expect to operate out of combat outposts or forward operating bases as they did in Iraq, where they could count on a warm bed and hot food more often than not. In contrast, soldiers can expect extended periods in the field, living out of a rucksack, dispersed and camouflaged in dug-in fighting positions before massing to attack. This was not the military's focus when Van Ockmill first met Matthias in 2006 in Mosul, Iraq. Right then, the U.S. military was transitioning to counterinsurgency, a population-centric style of warfare in which American troops spend time patrolling towns and villages, learning the cultural, political, ethnic, religious, and economic forces of a region, and ideally developing relationships with local leaders in an attempt to effect not simply military success, but a change in the nature of the society where they fight. The quintessential training exercise of the counterinsurgency era was the meetup with tribal elders. An infantry squad would patrol in an imaginary desert toward a pretend sheikh and drink chai while talking about how they could help improve security in the area. Sometimes the stand-in sheikh or elder was an actual Iraqi or Afghan immigrant hired to play the role with the utmost realism. In 2009, I remember sitting in a forest in North Carolina and asking a young infantryman headed to Afghanistan how his unit would succeed. Through cultural effectiveness, he told me, a line his leaders had clearly impressed upon him. That kid ended up in the famously violent Sangin district, where the cultural, political, ethnic, religious, and economic forces all converged on one point: murderous hostility to American troops. The Fort Campbell and Fort Johnson training sessions included a few of their own key leader engagements, simulated meetings with military and political leaders, but that wasn't the emphasis. In Van Ochtmel's photos, Humvees and even soldiers' heads are decorated with leafy branches, their goal to blend not with the local population, but with the inhuman landscape. It's a more natural and even comfortable place for professional soldiers to be, killers in hiding, not junior sociologists strolling through Murderville. Van Ochtmel, who for almost two decades has covered combat, especially the U.S. military at war, has documented units like this before. Young kids just out of high school, eager for combat. He's seen them turn into hardened veterans. He's seen the bloody tables of trauma hospitals, the post-war struggles of the burned and maimed, along with their triumphs and joys, the whole life cycle of war. Yet here he was, back at the beginning, in a fresh army unit where only one out of 20 soldiers has been to war, and fewer have been in an actual gunfight. They told me they didn't care who they fought, Russia or China. They just wanted to fight, he recounted, clearly disturbed that nothing these young men and women had seen or heard in their lives, lives lived almost entirely during the span of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, had seemed to have made them skeptical about who might send them to battle and why. What's strange, though, is that troops training for this style of warfare are likely to face a lot less actual combat than that young infantryman touting cultural effectiveness. Since the task of the 2nd Brigade Combat Team is to prepare for wars against countries with nuclear weapons, the balance of power will not be decided by the number of leafy branches you stick onto your Humvee. If a truly hot war with a nuclear-armed adversary comes, we have already lost. We, meaning not just America, but the whole human race. And even in a limited war, where both sides keep their nukes in reserve, the losses will quickly become staggering. If China fought it out, it'd be the first war since the Civil War where the U.S. mainland was threatened, Gady maintained. America's wars are never coming home to you. You always have a safe haven, like those Norman Rockwell paintings, where Thanksgiving will always be served. But China will have to hit U.S. critical infrastructure. There's not going to be a safe haven. And so training a brigade of soldiers skilled in the complex American style of warfare, where units maneuver flexibly and use a combination of arms, from tanks to artillery to light infantry to close air support, augmented by up-to-date technologies and strategies, is secretly all about ultimately not fighting. Which is precisely why, after these training exercises, the brigade headed to Eastern Europe, where it was the closest American force to the ongoing war, just 13 miles from the Ukrainian border with Romania. The brigade trained alongside 18 Allied partners, though the point of the deployment was as much to send a message as it was to build relationships and skills with other NATO militaries. Many of these exercises drew a Russian response in the media, Matyadis said, because they feared us in the region. Perhaps. It certainly let Russia know that America was getting ready for a potential face-off against the Russian army, and it signaled U.S. support and U.S. capabilities to the Eastern European countries whose lands would be the primary battleground in a broader war. When he was preparing to fight Russian proxy forces in the Donbas a few years prior to the Russian invasion of Ukraine, the Ukrainian soldier and writer Artem Chek described the impact of meeting American troops like the ones Matyidis commands. Chek looked around at the Ukrainian infantry, of which he was a part, a motley group with poor weapons and equipment, resembling, he noted, the homeless kids of the 1920s. Chek himself wasn't even wearing boots, but New Balance sneakers, and he was envied for his footwear. And then there were the Americans, the perfect image of how an army should be and how it should be equipped. "Look at their Hummers," he gushed to a fellow Ukrainian. "Look at their ammo. Look into the eyes of the African-American soldier with the high-tech gear." The Americans didn't go on to actually fight the Russians, though. The homeless kids of the 1920s did. While from the sidelines, U.S. troops and their NATO allies offered weaponry and training and assistance with operational planning, as well as assurance to the rest of Europe that their transatlantic brother was there to keep the alliance together. Chek, who is better equipped now but still fighting, spoke to me in May about his fellow soldiers coming to terms with the very real possibility of their own deaths in the coming months and years. "Those who make it through will have many more lessons about peer-to-peer combat to teach their stateside counterparts than the other way around." 2 decades ago, Van Uchtmul was not so different from the young soldiers he photographed. He was obsessed with war, eager to go into the teeth of it, even if he knew there were many things wrong about that impulse. When we connect with his images, impactful and ominously surreal, but also ambivalent and even untidy, it's not in judgment so much as through the lens of his own bewildered hindsight of 2 decades of combat photography. He knows how this works. To do their jobs, the young men in these photos need to be ready, even eager, for war. But if we ever have to fight the kind of war for which they are training, God help us. And in the final photos, the fog of war games. Battle prep entails colored smoke used to lure a unit into a would-be ambush at Fort Campbell, Kentucky. Combat 3.0. A soldier, his gear meant to blend into the field of battle, prepares to take over a house. Troops move in on an enemy village in a large-scale exercise at Fort Johnson. Camouflage covers a Humvee during nighttime drills at Fort Campbell. And Dawn Patrol. Soldiers of the 101st Airborne, soon to be deployed to Europe to help train other NATO forces, take enemy fire in a forest at Fort Johnson. We'll be right back. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.